surrender bond. She did so on April 18, 1893, with Holmes himself serving as notary. Bond, in turn, signed the deed over to another man, Benton T. Lyman. Holmes notarized this transfer as well. Minnie loved her husband-to-be and trusted him, but she did not know that Alexander Bond was an alias for Holmes himself, or that Benton Lyman actually was Holmes's assistant, Benjamin Pitetzel, and that with a few strokes of his pen, her beloved Harry had taken possession of the bulk of her dead uncle's bequest. Nor did she know that on paper Harry was still married to two other women, Clara Lovering and Myrta Belknap, and that in each marriage he had fathered a child. As Minnie's adoration deepened, Holmes executed a second financial maneuver. He established the Campbell Yates Manufacturing Company, which he billed as a firm that bought and sold everything. When he filed its papers of incorporation, he listed five officers: H. H. Holmes, M. R. Williams, A. S. Yates, Hiram S. Campbell, and Henry Owens. Owens was a porter employed by Holmes. Hiram S. Campbell was the fictive owner of Holmes's Englewood building. Yates was supposed to be a businessman living in New York City, but in reality was as much a fiction as Campbell. And M.R. Williams was Minnie. The company made nothing, sold nothing. It existed to hold assets and provide a reference for anyone who became skeptical of Holmes's promissory notes. Later, when questions arose as to the accuracy of the corporation papers, Holmes persuaded Henry Owens, the porter, to sign an affidavit swearing not only that he was secretary of the company, but that he had met both Yates and Campbell, and that Yates personally had handed him the stock certificates representing his share of the company. Owens later said of Holmes, "He induced me to make these statements by promising me my back wages and by his hypnotizing ways, and I candidly believe that he had a certain amount of influence over me. While I was with him, I was always under his control." He added, "I never received my back wages." Holmes, Harry, wanted the wedding done quickly and quietly, just him, Minnie, and a preacher. He arranged everything. To Minnie, the little ceremony appeared to be legal and, in its quiet way, very romantic. But in fact, no record of their union was entered into the marriage registry of Cook County, Illinois. Dreadful things done by girls. Throughout the spring of 1893, the streets of Chicago filled with unemployed men from elsewhere. But otherwise, the city seemed immune from the nation's financial troubles. Preparations for the fair kept its economy robust, if artificially so. Construction of the Alley L extension to Jackson Park still provided work for hundreds of men. In the company town of Pullman, just south of Chicago, workers labored around the clock to fill backlogged orders for more cars to carry visitors to the fair, though the rate of new orders had fallen off sharply. The Union Stockyard commissioned Burnham's firm to build a new passenger depot at its entrance, to manage the expected crush of fairgoers seeking a crimson break from the white city. Downtown, Montgomery Ward installed a new customer's parlor, where excursive fair visitors could loiter on soft couches while browsing the company's 500-page catalog. New hotels rose everywhere. One entrepreneur, Charles Kyler, believed that once his hotel opened, money would be so plentiful it would come a-running uphill to get into our coffers. At Jackson Park, exhibits arrived daily in ever-mounting volume. There was smoke, clatter, mud, and confusion, as if an army were massing for an assault on Chicago. Caravans of Wells Fargo and Adams Express wagons moved slowly through the park, drawn by gigantic horses. Throughout the night, freight trains huffed into the park. Switching locomotives nudged individual boxcars over the skein of temporary tracks to their destinations. Lake freighters disgorged pale wooden crates emblazoned with phrases and exotic alphabets. George Ferris's steel arrived on 5 trains of 30 cars each. The Inman steamship line delivered a full-sized section of one of its ocean liners. Bethlehem Steel brought giant ingots and great slabs of military armor, including a curved plate 17 inches thick, meant for the gun turret of the dreadnought Indiana. Great Britain delivered locomotives and ship models, including an exquisite 30-foot replica of Britain's latest warship, Victoria, so detailed that even the links of chain in its handrails were to scale. From Baltimore came a long, dark train that chilled the hearts of the men and women who monitored its passage across the prairie, but delighted the innumerable small boys who raced open-jawed to the railbed. The train carried weapons made by the Essen Works of Fritz Krupp, the German arms baron, including the largest artillery piece until then constructed, capable of firing a 1-ton shell with enough force to penetrate 3 feet of wrought iron plate. The barrel had to be carried on a specially made car consisting of a steel cradle straddling 2 extra-long flat cars. An ordinary car had 8 wheels. This combination had 32. The gun weighed 250,000 pounds. To ensure that the Pennsylvania Railroad's bridges could support such an immense load, 2 Krupp engineers had traveled to America the previous July to inspect the entire route. The gun quickly acquired the nickname Krupp's Baby, although one writer preferred to think of it as Krupp's pet monster. A train with a more light-hearted cargo also headed for Chicago, this one leased by Buffalo Bill for his Wild West show. It carried a small army. 100 former U.S. cavalry soldiers, 97 Cheyenne, Kiowa, Pawnee, and Sioux Indians, another 50 Cossacks and Hussars, 180 horses, 18 buffalo, 10 elk, 10 mules, and a dozen other animals. It also carried Phoebe Ann Moses of Tiffin, Ohio, a young woman with a penchant for guns and an excellent sense of distance. Bill called her Annie. The press called her Miss Oakley. At night, the Indians and soldiers played cards. Ships began converging on U.S. ports from all over the world, bearing exposition cargoes of the most exotic kind. Sphinxes, mummies, coffee trees, and ostriches. By far the most exotic cargo, however, was human. Alleged cannibals from Dahomey. Lapps from Lapland. Syrian horsemen. On March 9th, a steamer named Guildhall set sail for New York from Alexandria, Egypt, carrying 175 bona fide residents of Cairo, recruited by an entrepreneur named George Pangalos to inhabit his street in Cairo in the Midway Plaisance. In the Guildhall's holds, he stashed 20 donkeys, 7 camels, and an assortment of monkeys and deadly snakes. His passenger list included one of Egypt's foremost practitioners of the danse du ventre, the young and lushly feminine Farida Majar, destined to become a legend in America. Pangalos had secured choice ground at the middle of the Midway, adjacent to the Ferris wheel, in a Muslim diaspora that included a Persian concession, a Moorish palace, and Saul Bloom's Algerian village, where Bloom had converted the Algerians' premature arrival into a financial windfall. Bloom was able to open his village as early as August 1892, well before dedication day, and within a month had covered his costs and begun reaping a generous profit. The Algerian version of the danse du ventre had proven a particularly powerful draw, once people realized the phrase meant belly dance. Rumors spread of half-clad women jiggling away, when in fact the dance was elegant, stylized, and rather chaste. The crowds poured in, Bloom said. I had a gold mine. With his usual flair for improvisation, Bloom contributed something else that would forever color America's perception of the Middle East. The Press Club of Chicago invited him to present a preview of the danse du ventre to its members. Never one to shun free publicity, Bloom accepted instantly and traveled to the club with a dozen of his dancers. On arrival, however, he learned that for music all the club had provided was a lone pianist who had no idea what kind of piece might accompany such an exotic dance. Bloom thought a moment, hummed a tune, then plinked it out on the keyboard, one note at a time. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Over the next century, this tune and its variations would be deployed in a succession of mostly cheesy movies, typically as an accompaniment to the sinuous emergence of a cobra from a basket. It would also drive the schoolyard lyric, "And they wear no pants in the southern part of France." Bloom regretted his failure to copyright the tune. The royalties would have run into the millions. Sad news arrived from Zanzibar. There would be no pygmies. Lieutenant Schufeld was dead, of unclear causes. There was advice, much of it, of course, from New York. The advice that rankled most came from Ward McAllister, factotum and chief slipperlick to Mrs. William Astor, Empress of New York society. Appalled by the vision conjured by Chicago's Dedication Day, of creme and rabble mixing in such volume and with such indecorous propinquity, McAllister, in a column in the New York World, advised, "It is not quantity but quality that the society people here want. Hospitality, which includes the whole human race, is not desirable." He urged Chicago hostesses to hire some French chefs to improve their culinary diction. "In these modern days, society cannot get along without French chefs," he wrote. "The man who has been accustomed to delicate fillets of beef, terrapin pâté de foie gras, truffled turkey, and things of that sort, would not care to sit down to a boiled leg of mutton dinner with turnips." The thing is, McAllister was serious. And there was more. "I should also advise that they do not frappe their wine too much. Let them put the bottle in the tub and be careful to keep the neck free from ice. For the quantity of wine in the neck of the bottle being small, it will be acted upon by the ice first. In 25 minutes from the time of being placed in the tub, it will be in a perfect condition to be served immediately. What I mean by a perfect condition is that when the wine is poured from the bottle, it should contain little flakes of ice. That is a real frappe." To which the Chicago Journal replied, "The mayor will not frappe his wine too much. He will frappe it just enough so the guests can blow the foam off the tops of the glasses without a vulgar exhibition of lung and lip power. His ham sandwiches, sinkers, and Irish quail, better known in the Bridgeport vernacular as pig's feet, will be triumphs of the gastronomic art." One Chicago newspaper called McAllister a mouse-colored ass. Chicago delighted in such repartee, for the most part. On some level, however, McAllister's remarks stung. McAllister was one particularly snooty voice, but it was clear to everyone that he spoke with the sanction of New York's blue bloods. Among Chicago's leading citizens, there was always a deep fear of being second class. No one topped Chicago in terms of business drive and acumen, but within the city's upper echelons, there was a veiled anxiety that the city, in its commercial advance, may indeed have failed to cultivate the finer traits of man and woman. The exposition was to be a giant white banner waved in Mrs. Astor's face. With its gorgeous classical buildings packed with art, its clean water and electric lights, and its overstaffed police department, the exposition was Chicago's conscience, the city it wanted to become. Burnham in particular embodied this insecurity. Denied admission to Harvard and Yale and the right beginning, he had become a self-conscious connoisseur of fine things. He arranged recitals at his home and office and joined the best clubs and collected the best wines and was now leading the greatest non-military campaign in the nation's history. Even so, the social columnists still did not write about his wife's dresses when he and she attended the opera, the way they described the knightly couture of Mesdames Palmer, Palman, and Armour. The fair was to be Burnham's redemption and Chicago's. Outside peoples already concede our material greatness and that we are well-nigh supreme in manufactures and commerce, he wrote. They do, however, claim that we are not cultivated and refined to the same extent. To remove this impression, the thought and work of this bureau has been mostly bent from the start. Advice arrived also by the bookful. An author named Adelaide Hollingsworth chose to honor the fair with over 700 pages of it, which she published early in the year under the title The Columbia Cookbook. Although her book did include compelling recipes for scrapple, ox cheek, and baked calf's head, and tips for the preparation of raccoon, possum, snipe, plovers, and blackbirds for blackbird pie, and how to broil, fricassee, stew, or fry a squirrel, it was much more than just a cookbook. Hollingsworth billed it as an overall guide to helping modern young housewives create a peaceful, optimistic, and sanitary household. The wife was to set the tenor of the day. The breakfast table should not be a bulletin board for the curing of horrible dreams and depressing symptoms, but the place where a bright keynote of the day is struck. In places Hollingsworth advice revealed, by refraction, a certain Victorian raciness. In a segment on how best to wash silk underwear, she advised, if the article is black, add a little ammonia instead of acid to the rinsing water. One of the most persistent problems of the day was offensive feet, caused by the prevailing habit of washing feet only once a week. To combat this, Hollingsworth wrote, take one part muriatic acid to 10 parts of water. Rub the feet every night with this mixture before retiring to bed. To rid your mouth of the odor of onions, drink strong coffee. Oysters made the best rat bait. To induce cream to whip, add a grain of salt. To keep milk sweet longer, add horseradish. Hollingsworth offered sage medical advice. Don't sit between a fever patient and a fire, and provided various techniques for dealing with medical emergencies, such as accidental poisoning. Among a list of measures effective for inducing vomiting, she included injections of tobacco into the anus through a pipe stem. Jacob Riis, the New York journalist who had devoted himself to revealing the squalid housing of America's poor, came to Chicago bearing counsel of a graver sort. In March, he gave a talk at Hull House, a reform settlement founded by Jane Addams, St. Jane. Hull House had become a bastion of progressive thought inhabited by strong-willed young women, interspersed, as one visitor put it, with earnest-faced, self-subordinating, and mild-mannered men who slide from room to room apologetically. Clarence Darrow regularly walked the short distance from his office in the Rookery to Hull House, where he was admired for his intellect and social empathy, but disparaged privately for his slovenly dress and less-than-exemplary hygiene. At the time of Riis's talk, Riis and Addams were two of the best-known people in America. Riis had toured Chicago's foulest districts and pronounced them worse than anything he had seen in New York. In his talk, he noted the fast approach of the exposition and warned his audience, "You ought to begin house cleaning, so to speak, and get your alleys and streets in better condition. Never in our worst season have we had so much filth in New York City." In fact, Chicago had been trying to tidy itself for some time and had found the challenge monumental. The city stepped up its efforts to remove garbage and began repaving alleys and streets. It deployed smoke inspectors to enforce a new anti-smoke ordinance. Newspapers launched crusades against pestilent alleys and excess smoke and identified the worst offenders in print. Among them, Burnham's newly opened Masonic Temple, which the Chicago Tribune likened to Mount Vesuvius. Carrie Watson, Chicago's foremost madam, decided her own operation merited a little sprucing up. Her place already was luxurious, with a bowling alley where the pins were bottles of chilled champagne, but now she resolved to increase the number of bedrooms and double her staff. She and other brothel owners anticipated a big spike in demand. They would not be disappointed. Nor, apparently, would their clients. Later, a madam named Chicago May recalled the boisterous year of the fair with a cringe. What dreadful things were done by some of the girls. It always made me sick even to think of them. The mere mention of the details of some of the circuses is unprintable. I think Rome, at its worst, had nothing on Chicago during those lurid days. The man who helped make Chicago so hospitable to Carrie Watson and Chicago May, as well as to Mickey Finn and Bathhouse John Coughlin and a few thousand other operators of saloons and gambling dens, was Carter Henry Harrison, whose 4 terms as mayor had gone a long way to establish Chicago as a place that tolerated human frailty, even as it nurtured grand ambition. After his failed run for the office in 1891, Harrison had acquired a newspaper, the Chicago Times, and settled into the job of editor. By the end of 1892, however, he had made it clear that he would love to be the fair mayor and lead the city through its most glorious time, but insisted that only a clear signal of popular demand could make him enter the campaign. He got it. Carter H. Harrison Associations sprang up all over town, and now, at the start of 1893, Carter was one of 2 candidates for the Democratic nomination, the other being Washington Hessing, editor of the powerful German daily Staatszeitung. Every newspaper in the city, other than his own Times, opposed Harrison, as did Burnham and most of Chicago's leading citizens. To Burnham and the others, the new Chicago, as symbolized by the White City rising in Jackson Park, required new leadership. Certainly not Harrison. The city's legions of working men disagreed. They always had counted Harrison as one of their own. Our Carter, even though he was a plantation-reared Kentucky man who had gone to Yale, spoke fluent French and German, and recited lengthy passages from Shakespeare. He had served 4 terms. That he should serve a 5th in the year of the fair seemed fitting, and a wave of nostalgia swept the city's wards. Even his opponents recognized that Harrison, despite his privileged roots, made an intensely appealing candidate for the city's lesser tier. Harrison was magnetic. He was able and willing to talk to anyone about anything, and had a way of making himself the center of any conversation. His friends all noticed it, said Joseph Medill, once an ally but later Harrison's most ardent opponent. They would laugh or smile about it and called it Carter Harrisonia. Even at 68, Harrison exuded strength and energy, and women generally agreed that he was more handsome now than he had been in his 50s. Widowed 2x, he was rumored to be involved with a much younger woman. He had deep blue eyes with large pupils and an unwrinkled face. He attributed his youthful aspect to a heavy dose of morning coffee. His quirks made him endearing. He loved watermelon. When it was in season, he ate it at all 3 meals. He had a passion for shoes, a different pair each day of the week, and for silk underwear. Almost everyone had seen Harrison riding the streets on his white Kentucky mare, in his black slouch hat, trailing a plume of cigar smoke. At his campaign talks, he often addressed his remarks to a stuffed eagle that he carried with him as a prop. Medill accused him of nurturing the city's basest instincts, but also called him the most remarkable man that our city has ever produced. To the astonishment of the city's ruling class, 78% of the 681 delegates to the Democratic Convention voted for Harrison on the first ballot. The Democratic elite implored the Republicans to come up with a candidate that they too could support, anything to keep Harrison from returning to office. The Republicans chose Samuel W. Allerton, a rich packer from Prairie Avenue. The biggest and most powerful newspapers formed an explicit combine to back Allerton and undermine Harrison. The ex-mayor countered their attacks with humor. During a talk before a large group of supporters at the auditorium, Harrison called Allerton a most admirable pig sticker and pig slaughterer. I admit it, and I don't arraign him because he slaughters the Queen's English. He can't help it. Harrison rapidly gained ground. Patrick Prendergast, the young, mad Irish immigrant, took pride in Harrison's renewed popularity and believed his own efforts at promoting the ex-mayor for re-election had a lot to do with the campaign's new momentum. An idea came to Prendergast. Just when it entered his brain, he could not say, but it was there, and it gave him satisfaction. He had read extensively into law and politics and understood that political machines operated on a first principle of power. If you worked to advance the interests of the machine paid you back. Harrison was in his debt. This notion came to Prendergast initially as a glimmer, like the first sunlight to strike the Masonic Tower each morning. But now he thought of it 1,000 times a day. It was his treasure and made him square his shoulders and raise his chin. When Harrison won, things would change. And Harrison would win. The great upwelling of enthusiasm in the ward seemed to assure Harrison's victory. Once elected, Prendergast believed Harrison would offer him an appointment. He would have to. It was the law of the machine, as immutable as the forces that propelled the Chicago Limited across the prairie. Prendergast wanted to be corporation counsel. No more dealing with newsboys who did not know their place. No more walking in the yellow stew that bubbled between pavers. No more having to breathe the awful perfume of mortified horses left in the middle of the street. When Harrison took office, salvation would come to Patrick Prendergast. The idea caused moments of exultation. Prendergast bought more postcards and sent exuberant notes to the men who soon would be his associates and clubmates, the judges, lawyers, and merchant princes of Chicago. He, of course, sent another card to his good friend Alfred S. Trude, the defense attorney. "My dear Mr. Trude," he began. He intended the next word to be hallelujah, but certain words gave him trouble. In his fever to write, he plunged ahead. "Alleluia," he wrote. "The attempt of the Herald gang to prevent the manifestation of the popular will has been checked, and Carter H. Harrison, the popular choice, will be our next mayor. The newspaper trust has been ingloriously sat down upon. What do I know about the candidacy of a Washington Hessing, poor fellow? He has the tail end of my sympathy. In his present trouble, I hope it will not overcome him, and the noble newspaper trust. Glory to the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost." He rambled on for a few more lines, then closed, "Friendship is the true test of character, after all. Sincerely, P.E.J. Prendergast." Again, something in the card drew Trude's attention. Many other recipients of Prendergast's cards also took note, despite the crush of mail each received from his true peers, this being a time when everyone who knew how to write did so, and at length. In that glacier of words grinding toward the 20th century, Prendergast's card was a single fragment of mica glinting with lunacy, pleading to be picked up and pocketed. Once again, Trude kept the letter. In April 1893, the citizens of Chicago elected Carter Henry Harrison to his fifth term. In preparation for the fair, he ordered 200 barrels of whiskey to be used by his office in the entertainment of dignitaries. He gave no thought whatsoever to Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast. A mistake, as it happens, and one of grave consequence for himself, the fair, and Burnham. The invitation. For the moment, Holmes held off on doing anything more with Minnie's property. Minnie had told her sister Anna of the transfer of the Fort Worth land, and now Holmes sensed that Anna was becoming suspicious of his true intentions. This did not trouble him, however. The solution was really quite simple. One bright and fragrant spring day, as if on a wild equinoctial whim, Holmes suggested that Minnie invite her sister to Chicago to see the World's Fair at his expense. Minnie was delighted and sent the good news to Anna, who immediately accepted. Holmes knew she would, for how could she have done otherwise? The chance to see Minnie was compelling in itself. Add Chicago and the Great Fair, and the combination became too alluring to turn down, no matter what Anna suspected about his and Minnie's relationship. Minnie could hardly wait for the end of the school year when her sister at last would be able to extricate herself from her duties at the Midlothian Academy. Minnie planned to show Anna all the wonders of Chicago. The skyscrapers, Marshall Field's store, the auditorium, and, of course, the World's Fair. But above all, she looked forward to introducing Anna to her own personal wonder, Mr. Henry Gordon, her Harry. At last, Anna would see that she could put her suspicions to rest. Final preparations. In the first 2 weeks of April 1893, the weather was gorgeous, but other cruelties abounded. 4 exposition workers lost their lives, 2 from fractured skulls, 2 electrocuted. The deaths brought the year's total to 7. The exposition's union carpenters, aware of their great value in this final phase of construction, seized the moment and walked off the job, demanding a minimum union wage and other long-sought concessions. Only 1 of the 8 towers of the Ferris wheel was in place, and workers had not yet completed repairs to the manufacturer's building. Each morning, hundreds of men climbed to its roof. Each evening, they picked their way gingerly down in a long, dense line that, from a distance, resembled a column of ants. Frank Millett's whitewash gang worked furiously to paint the buildings of the Court of Honor. In places, the staff coating already had begun to crack and chip. Patch crews patrolled the grounds. The air of anxious effort that suffused the park reminded Candace Wheeler, the designer hired to decorate the woman's building, of an insufficiently equipped household preparing for visitors. Despite the carpenter's strike and all the work yet to be done, Burnham felt optimistic, his mood bolstered by the fine weather. The winter had been deep and long, but now the air was scented with first blossoms and thawed earth. And he felt loved. In late March, he had been fêted at a grand banquet arranged largely by Charles McKim and held in New York at Madison Square Garden. The old garden, an elegant columned structure designed by McKim's partner, Stanford White. McKim assigned Frank Millett to recruit the attendance of the nation's finest painters, and these took their seats beside the most prominent writers and architects and the patrons who supported them all. Men like Marshall Field and Henry Villard, and together they spent the night lauding Burnham, prematurely, for achieving the impossible. Of course, they ate like gods. The menu? Blue points à l'Alaska. Sauterne. Potage. Consommé printanier. Crème de céleri. Amontillado. Hors d'oeuvres. Rissole Chateaubriand, amande salée, olives, etc. Poisson. Basse riée, sauce hollandaise, pomme parisienne. Mirsfeiner. Mouet et Chandon. Perrier Jouif. Extra dry special. Ruffève. Filet de bœuf au champignon. Haricot vert. Pomme duchesse. Entrée. Riz de veau en côtelette. Petit pois. Sorbet. Romaine, fantaisie, cigarettes. Rôti. Canard de tête rouge. Salade de lettuce. Ponte cane. Dessert. Petit moule fantaisie. Gâteau assorti. Bonbons. Petit four. Fruit assorti. Fromage. Roquefort à camembert. Café. Apollinari. Cognac, cordials, cigars. Newspapers reported that Olmsted also was present, but in fact he was in Asheville, North Carolina, continuing his work on Vanderbilt's estate. His absence prompted speculation that he had stayed away out of pique at not being invited to share the podium, and because the invitation had identified the major arts only as painting, architecture, and sculpture, with no reference to landscape architecture. While it is true that Olmsted had struggled throughout his career to build respect for landscape architecture as a distinct branch of the fine arts, for him to shun the banquet because of hurt feelings would have been out of character. The simplest explanation seems best. Olmsted was ill, his work everywhere was behind schedule, he disliked ceremonies, and above all, he loathed long-distance train travel, especially in transitional months when rail cars, even the finest Pullman palaces, were likely to be too hot or too cold. Had he attended, he would have heard Burnham tell the guests, "Each of you knows the name and genius of him who stands first in the heart and confidence of American artists, the creator of your own and many other city parks. He it is who has been our best advisor and our constant mentor. In the highest sense, he is the planner of the exposition, Frederick Law Olmsted. An artist, he paints with lakes and wooded slopes, with lawns and banks and forest-covered hills, with mountainsides and ocean views. He should stand where I do tonight." Which is not to say that Burnham wanted to sit down. He reveled in the attention and adored the engraved silver loving cup that was filled with wine and held to the lips of every man at the table. Despite the prevalence in the city outside of typhoid, diphtheria, tuberculosis, and pneumonia. He knew the praise was premature, but the banquet hinted at the greater glory that would accrue to him at fair's end, provided, of course, the exposition met the world's elaborate expectations. Without doubt, huge progress had been made. The six grandest buildings of the exposition towered over the central basin with an effect more dramatic and imposing than even he had imagined. Daniel Chester French's Statue of the Republic, nicknamed Big Mary, stood in the basin complete and gleaming, its entire surface gilded. Including plinth, the Republic was 111 feet tall. Over 200 other buildings erected by states, corporations, and foreign governments stippled the surrounding acreage. The White Star Line had built a charming little temple at the northwest bank of the lagoon opposite the wooded island, with steps to the water. The monstrous guns of Krupp were in place in their pavilion on the lake south of the Court of Honor. "The scale of the whole thing is more and more tremendous as the work proceeds," McKim wrote to Richard Hunt. "A bit too tremendous," he noted cattily, "at least in the case of the manufacturer's building." His own agriculture building, he wrote, must suffer by comparison with its huge neighbor opposite, whose volume, 215 feet high, off the main axis, is bound to swamp us and everything else around it. He told Hunt he had just spent 2 days with Burnham, including 2 nights at the shanty. "He is keeping up under his responsibilities and looking well, and we all owe him a great debt for his constant watchfulness and attention to our slightest wishes." Even the carpenter's strike did not trouble Burnham. There seemed to be plenty of unemployed non-union carpenters willing to step in for the absent strikers. "I fear nothing at all from this source," he wrote on April 6th in a letter to Margaret. "The day was cold, but clear, bright, and beautiful. A splendid day to live and work in." Workers were putting in the embellishments, he wrote. "A lot of ducks were put in the lagoons yesterday, and they are floating around contentedly and quite like life this morning." Olmsted had ordered over 800 ducks and geese and 7,000 pigeons, and for the sake of accent, a number of exotic birds, including 4 snowy egrets, 4 storks, 2 brown pelicans, and 2 flamingos. So far, only the common white ducks had been introduced into the waters. In 2 or 3 days, Burnham wrote, all the birds will be in the water, which already commences to be still more beautiful than last year. The weather remained lovely, crisp, clear, and dry. On Monday, April 10th, he told Margaret, I am very happy. Over the next few days, his mood changed. There was talk that other unions might join the carpenter's strike and bring all work in Jackson Park to a halt. Suddenly, the exposition seemed dangerously far from ready. Construction of the sheds for the stock exhibits at the south end of the grounds had yet to begin. Everywhere Burnham looked, he saw rail tracks and temporary roads, empty boxcars and packing crates. Tumbleweeds of excelsior roved the grounds. He was disappointed with the unfinished appearance of the park, and he was peeved at his wife. Why do you not write me every day? He asked on Thursday. I look in vain for your letters. He kept a photograph of Margaret in his office. Every time he walked by it, he picked it up and stared at it with longing. So far that day, he told her, he had looked at it 10 times. He had counted on a rest after May 1st, but realized now that the intensity would persist until long afterward. The public will regard the work as entirely done, and I wish it were so, far as I am concerned. I presume anyone running a race has moments of half-despair along toward the end, but they must never be yielded to. Margaret sent him a 4-leafed clover. There was disarray in the fairgrounds, but not next door on the 15 acres of ground leased by Buffalo Bill for his show, which now bore the official title, Buffalo Bill's Wild West and Congress of Rough Riders of the World. He was able to open his show on April 3rd and immediately filled his 18,000-seat arena. Visitors entered through a gate that featured Columbus on one side under the banner Pilot of the Ocean, the first pioneer, and Buffalo Bill on the other, identified as Pilot of the Prairie, the last pioneer. His show and camp covered 15 acres. Its hundreds of Indians, soldiers, and workers slept in tents. Annie Oakley always made hers very homey, with a garden outside of primrose, geranium, and hollyhock. Inside, she placed her couch, cougar skins, an Axminster carpet, rocking chairs, and assorted other artifacts of domestic life. And, of course, a diverse collection of guns. Buffalo Bill always began his show with his cowboy band playing the Star-Spangled Banner. Next came the Grand Review, during which soldiers from America, England, France, Germany, and Russia paraded on horseback around his arena. Annie Oakley came next, blasting away at an array of impossible targets. She hit them. Another of the show's staples was an Indian attack on an old stagecoach, the Deadwood Mail coach, with Buffalo Bill and his men coming to the rescue. During the show's earlier engagement in London, the Indians attacked the coach as it raced across the grounds of Windsor Castle, carrying 4 kings and the Prince of Wales. Buffalo Bill drove. Late in the program, Cody himself demonstrated some fancy marksmanship, dashing around the arena on horseback while firing his Winchester at glass balls hurled into the air by his assistants. The climax of the show was the attack on a settler's cabin, during which Indians who once had slaughtered soldiers and civilians alike staged a mock attack on a cabin full of white settlers, only to be vanquished yet again by Buffalo Bill and a company of cowboys firing blanks. As the season advanced, Cody replaced the attack with the even more dramatic Battle of the Little Bighorn, showing with historical accuracy the scene of Custer's last charge. The fair was hard on Colonel Cody's marriage. The show always kept him away from his home in North Platte, Nebraska, but his absence wasn't the main problem. Bill liked women, and women liked Bill. One day his wife Louisa, Lulu, traveled to Chicago for a surprise conjugal visit. she found that Bill's wife already had arrived. At the hotel's front desk, a clerk told her she would now be escorted up to Mr. and Mrs. Cody's suite. Fearful that a wider strike could hobble the fair, even destroy it, Burnham began negotiations with the carpenters and ironworkers and agreed at last to establish a minimum wage and to pay time and a half for extra hours, double time for Sundays and key holidays, including, significantly, Labor Day. The union men in turn signed a contract to work until the end of the fair. Burnham's clear relief suggests that his earlier bravado might have been just for show. "You can imagine, though tired, I go to bed happy," he wrote to his wife. One measure of his exhaustion was the fact that the contorted syntax he usually worked so hard to suppress had now resurfaced. "We sat from early in the afternoon to 9 o'clock. Till the fair is over, this trial will not recur, I believe, so your picture before me is unusually lovely as it looks up from the desk." Burnham claimed the agreement was a victory for the exposition, but in fact the fair's concessions were a breakthrough for organized labor, and the resulting contracts became models for other unions to emulate. The fair's capitulation pumped steam into America's and Chicago's already boiling labor movement. Olmsted returned to Chicago accompanied by his usual troika of affliction and found the place galvanized, Burnham everywhere at once. On Thursday, April 13th, Olmsted wrote to his son John, "Everybody here in a keen rush, the greatest in imaginable outward confusion." Winds raced over the park's barren stretches and raised blizzards of dust. Train after train arrived bearing exhibits that should have been installed long before. The delayed installations meant that temporary tracks and roads had to remain in place. 2 days later, Olmsted wrote, "We shall have to bear the blame of everyone else's tardiness, as their operations are now everywhere in our way. At best, the most important part of all our work will have to be done at night after the opening of the exposition. I cannot see any way through the confusion, but there are thousands of men at work under various chiefs, and I suppose by and by the great labor will begin to tell together." He assigned some of the blame for the incomplete landscape to himself for failing to install a trustworthy overseer in Chicago after the death of Harry Codman. On April 15, 1893, he wrote to his son John, "I am afraid that we were wrong in leaving the business so much to Ulrich and Phil. Ulrich is not, I hope, intentionally dishonest, but he is perverse to the point of deceiving and misleading us and cannot be depended on. His energy is largely exhausted on matters that he should not be concerned with. I cannot trust him from day to day." His frustration with Ulrich grew, his distrust deepened. Later, in another note to John, he said, "Ulrich is unwittingly faithless to us. The difficulty is that he is ambitious of honors out of his proper line. Cares more to be more extraordinarily active, industrious, zealous, and generally useful than to achieve fine results in L.A., landscape architecture." Olmsted grew especially leery of Ulrich's slavish attentiveness to Burnham. "He is all over the grounds, about all sorts of business, and Mr. Burnham and every head of department is constantly calling for Ulrich. In going over the works with Burnham, I find him constantly repeating to his secretary, 'Tell Ulrich to do this and that.' I remonstrate, but it does little good. I can never find him at the work except by special appointment, and then he is impatient to get away." At heart, what Olmsted feared was that Burnham had transferred his loyalty to Ulrich. "I suppose that our time is out. Our engagement ended, and I fear that Burnham is disposed to let us go and depend on Ulrich, for Burnham is not competent to see the incompetency of Ulrich and the need of deliberate thought. I have to be cautious not to bore Burnham, who is, of course, enormously overloaded." Other obstacles quickly appeared. An important shipment of plants from California failed to arrive, worsening an already critical shortage of all plants. Even the fine weather that prevailed in the first couple of weeks of April caused delays. The lack of rain and the fact the park's waterworks were not yet completed meant Olmsted could not plant exposed portions of the grounds. The wind-blown dust, frightful dust, he said, regular sandstorms of the desert, continued and stung his eyes and propelled grit into his inflamed mouth. "I am trying to suggest why I seem to be accomplishing so little," he wrote. "I think the public for a time will be awfully disappointed with our work. Dissatisfied and a strong hand will be required here for weeks to come to prevent Ulrich's energies from being wrongly directed." By April 21st, Olmsted was again confined to bed, with sore throat, an ulcerating tooth, and much pain preventing sleep. Despite all this, his spirits began slowly to improve. When he looked past the immediate delays and Ulrich's duplicity, he saw progress. The shore of the wooded island was just now beginning to burst forth in a dense profusion of new leaves and blossoms, and the Japanese temple, the huden crafted in Japan and assembled by Japanese artisans, detracted little from the sylvan effect. The electric boats had arrived and were lovely, exactly what Olmsted had hoped for, and the waterfowl on the lagoons provided enchanting sparks of energy in counterpoint to the static white immensity of the Court of Honor. Olmsted recognized that Burnham's forces could not possibly finish patching and painting by May 1st, and that his own work would be far from complete, but he saw clear improvement. "A larger force is employed," he wrote, "and every day's work tells." Even this flicker of optimism was about to disappear, however, for a powerful weather front was moving across the prairie toward Chicago. During this period, the exact date unclear, a milk peddler named Joseph McCarthy stopped his cart near Chicago's Humboldt Park. It was morning, about 11 o'clock. A man in the park had caught his attention. He realized he knew the man. Patrick Prendergast, a newspaper distributor employed by the Interocean. The odd thing was, Prendergast was walking in circles. Odder still, he walked with his head tipped back, and his hat pulled so low it covered his eyes. As McCarthy watched, Prendergast walked face first into a tree. Rain began to fall. At first, it did not trouble Burnham. It suppressed the dust that rose from the unplanted portions of the grounds, of which he was disappointed to see there were far too many. And by now all the roofs were finished, even the roof of the Manufacturers and Liberal Arts Building. "It rains," Burnham wrote to Margaret on Tuesday, April 18th, "and for the first time I say let it. My roofs are in such good order at last. As to leaks, we care little." But the rain continued and grew heavier. At night it fell past the electric lights in sheets so thick they were nearly opaque. It turned the dust to mud, which caused horses to stagger and wagons to stall. And it found leaks. On Wednesday night, a particularly heavy rain came pounding through Jackson Park, and soon a series of 200-foot cataracts began tumbling from the glass ceiling of the Manufacturers Building onto the exhibits below. Burnham and an army of workers and guards converged on the building and together spent the night fighting the leaks. "Last night turned out the most terrible storm we have had in Jackson Park," Burnham wrote Margaret on Thursday. No damage was done to the buildings on grounds except that the roofs of the Manufacturers Building leaked on the east side, and we stayed there until midnight, covering up goods. One of the papers says that General Davis was on hand and attending to things, and that he never left the building till all was safe. Of course, Mr. D. had nothing whatever to do with it. The rain seemed to bring into focus just how much work remained. That same Thursday, Burnham wrote another letter to Margaret. "The weather is very bad here and has so continued since last Tuesday, but I keep right along, although the most gigantic work lies before us. The intensity of this last month is very great indeed. You can little imagine it. I am surprised at my own calmness under it all." But the challenge, he said, had tested his lieutenants. The strain on them shows who is made of good metal and who is not. I can tell you that very few come right up to the mark under these conditions, but there are some who can be depended on. The rest have to be pounded every hour of the day, and they are the ones who make me tired. As always, he longed for Margaret. She was out of the city, but due back for the opening. "I will be on the lookout for you, my dear girl," he wrote. "You must expect to give yourself up when you come." For this buttoned-up age, for Burnham, it was a letter that could have steamed itself open. Day after day, the same thing. Fogged windows, paper curled from ambient moisture, the demonic applause of rain on rooftops, and everywhere the stench of sweat and moist wool, especially in the workers' mess at lunch hour. Rain filled electrical conduits and shorted circuits. At the Ferris wheel, the pumps meant to drain the tower excavations ran 24 hours, but could not conquer the volume of water. Rain poured through the ceiling of the woman's building and halted the installation of exhibits. In the midway, the Egyptians and Algerians and half-clothed Dahomans suffered. Only the Irish, in Mrs. Hart's Irish village, seemed to take it in stride. For Olmsted, the rain was particularly disheartening. It fell on ground already saturated and filled every dip in every path. Puddles became lakes. The wheels of heavily loaded wagons sank deep into the mud and left gaping lacerations, adding to the list of wounds to be filled, smoothed, and sodded. Despite the rain, the pace of work increased. Olmsted was awed by the sheer numbers of workers involved. On April 27th, 3 days before the opening, he reported to his firm, "I wrote you that there were 2,000 men employed." Foolishly. There have been 2,000 men employed directly by Mr. Burnham. This week, there are more than twice that number, exclusive of contractors' forces. Including contractors' and concessionaires' forces, there are now 10,000 men at work on the ground, and would be more if more of certain classes could be obtained. Our work is badly delayed because teams cannot be hired in sufficient numbers. His estimate was low. In those closing weeks, the total number of workers in the park was almost 20,000. He was still desperately short of plants, he complained. All resources for these seem to have failed, and the want of them will be serious in its result. His ulcerated tooth, at least, had improved, and he was no longer confined to bed. "My ulcer has shrunk," he wrote. "I still have to live on bread and milk, but am going about in the rain today and getting better." That same day, however, he wrote John a private and far bleaker letter. "We are having bad luck. Heavy rain again today." Burnham was pressuring him to take all manner of shortcuts to get the Court of Honor into presentable shape, such as having his men fill pots with rhododendrons and palms to decorate terraces, precisely the kind of showy, transient measures that Olmsted disdained. "I don't like it at all," he wrote. He resented having to resort to temporary expedients merely to make a poor show for the opening. He knew that immediately after the opening all such work would have to be redone. His ailments, his frustration, and the mounting intensity of the work taxed his spirits and caused him to feel older than his age. The diet of the provisional mess table, the noise and scurry and the puddles and rain do not leave a dilapidated old man much comfort, and my throat and mouth are still in such condition that I have to keep slopping victuals. He did not give up, however. Despite the rain, he jolted around the grounds to direct planting and sodding, and every morning at dawn attended Burnham's mandatory muster of key men. The exertion and weather reversed the improvement in his health. "I took cold and was up all night with bone trouble and am living on toast and tea," he wrote on Friday, April 28th. "Nearly constant heavy rain all the day, checking our work sadly." Yet the frenzy of preparations for Monday's opening continued unabated. It is queer to see the painters at work on ladders and scaffolds in this heavy rain, Olmsted wrote. Many are completely drenched, and I should think their painting must be streaky. He noticed that the big Columbia fountain at the western